Welcome to the Neuroscience Audio Tutorial Series by Rapid Learning Center. In this audio tutorial, we will discuss neuroscience, historical development of current concepts. This tutorial is part of Core Unit Number 1 of the Neuroscience course. By completing this tutorial, you will understand the scope of neuroscience and where it fits into science. Appreciate the history of neuroscience and be able to name key events. Understand and describe the current premise of neuroscience. Describe the various fields of neuroscientific study, and describe the main types of clinical study in neuroscience. This tutorial will explore four main topics. First, we will explore the question, what is neuroscience? We will then look at why we are studying neuroscience, the importance of this study. We will then delve into a brief history of key concepts developed over the centuries in regards to the brain and the nervous system. These concepts will be presented from ancient times, the Renaissance, and the 19th century. We will then look at current views in neuroscience and see how these emphasize the importance of this field of study. We will finish this tutorial by looking at the types of experimental neuroscientists and the medical specialists within neuroscience. Let's start with a discussion on the scope of this course. We will look at the unit-by-unit organization and then tutorial by tutorial on each unit. The neuroscience course consists of five core units. The first core unit covers the introduction to neuroscience and consists of four tutorials. The second core unit covers neural communication and includes four tutorials. The third core unit covers sensory and motor systems and consists of five tutorials. The fourth core unit covers psychobiology and includes seven tutorials. The fifth and final core unit covers advanced topics and consists of four tutorials. Each of these core units has been specifically selected to provide you with a comprehensive and progressive exploration of the key components of neuroscience, such that by the end of this course, you will have a strong basis of neuroscience knowledge. Let's take a closer look at each core unit. Core unit number one focuses on the introduction to neuroscience. This unit will cover the following four tutorials. Tutorial number one, neuroscience, historical development of current concepts. Tutorial number two, the structure of the nervous system. Tutorial number three, the development of the nervous system. And tutorial number four, the cells of the nervous system, including neurons and various glial cells. The second core unit will focus on various aspects of neural communication within the cell and between cells, and will include the following tutorials. Tutorial number five, the resting neuronal membrane. Tutorial number six, the action potential. Tutorial number seven, information transfer at the synapse. Tutorial number eight, neurotransmitter systems. At this point in the course, you will have a sound understanding of neural signaling and synaptic transmission. You will now explore how this foundation is woven together into the sensory and motor systems. The tutorials included in this core unit are Tutorial number 9, Touch, Temperature, and Pain, the Somatic Sensory System. Tutorial number 10, Control of Movement. Tutorial 11, Taste and Smell, the Chemical Senses. Tutorial 12, Hearing and Equilibrium. And Tutorial 13, The Eye and Visual Processing. You will now have the opportunity to journey into a world in which the basic anatomy and physiology combine with the psychology inherent in neuroscience. In Core Unit Number 4, you will integrate prior knowledge by exploring various topics within psychobiology. The tutorials included in this core unit are Tutorial 14, Control of the Brain and Behavior Through Chemicals. Tutorial 15, Learning and Motivation. Tutorial 16, Determinants of Sexual Behavior and Gender. Tutorial 17, Neuronal Determinants of Emotion. Tutorial 18, Sleep Rhythms Within the Brain. Tutorial 19, Language and the Brain. And Tutorial 20, Finding Focus, Attention Determinants. Core Unit Number 5 will look at a few of the advanced topics in neuroscience. The core unit includes the following tutorials. Tutorial 21, Memory Systems in the Brain. Tutorial 22, Learning and Memory Mechanism. Tutorial 23, Diseases of the Nervous System. And finally, Tutorial 24, Stress and the Brain. By the end of this core unit, you will comprehend and appreciate the intricacies of connections, communication, and complexity of the billions of cells located within your nervous system. Are you ready to get started on this exciting exploration? Let's begin. Now to the question, what is neuroscience? In this section, we will define the term neuroscience and look at its relation to other sciences. Neuroscience can be defined as the study of the brain and nervous system from many different perspectives, to include molecular, the molecules involved in the specific functioning of this field of science, cellular, the specialized cells involved in this field of science and their particular functions. Behavioral, the effect of behavior on the brain and nervous system and the effect of the brain and nervous system on behavior. Cognitive, the effect of the brain and nervous system on memory, learning, awareness, and attention. And pathologies, the specific diseases that develop from malfunctioning of the brain and the nervous system. All of these aspects taken together comprise the study of the brain and the nervous system. So exactly where does neuroscience fit in with the other sciences? While the world of neuroscience is rather young, it is human nature to be curious about how we see and hear, why some things feel good and others hurt, how we move, how we learn, remember, and forget, and the nature of anger and madness. Historically, the scientists who devoted themselves to an understanding of the nervous system came from many different scientific disciplines. It was rather recently that scientists came to the realization that the best hope for understanding the workings of the brain came from an interdisciplinary approach. Therefore, neuroscience combines many different scientific disciplines to include physiology, the study of how an organism, such as humans, function. Anatomy, the study of the structures within an organism, such as humans. And psychology, the study of the behavior of a species, such as humans. All of these disciplines are contained within the integrated field of study, known as neuroscience. Topic number 2, the importance of neuroscience. So why should a person study the brain and nervous system? What is so miraculous about how we move, how we sense things, and why we feel the way we do? In topic number 2, I will first provide you with an exciting visualization of neuroscience, and then I will present to you some of the burning questions facing neuroscientists today. From there, we will explore the basic premise of neuroscience and briefly look at some of the pathologies that can arise when things go wrong in the brain and the nervous system. Are you ready? Picture a city the size of the world, with as many buildings as people on Earth. Imagine that each of these buildings communicates with every other building at a speed so fast it would make your head spin. Now take this huge city and connect it to over 1 million other cities so that all of them are interconnected, and shrink them down and down to the size of, say, the human brain. The human brain is made up of billions of brain cells, neurons, that receive input from thousands of other cells before sending its own signal that spreads out to yet other cells. These brain cells are organized into groups, like cities, each group with its own area of the body to deal with or function to perform. Think about it. Billions of neurons within your brain. But that's not all. Also within your brain are other cell types. Some cells helping the neurons to communicate, others fighting infection and inflammation. These other cell types are even more abundant than neurons. Add to that the huge roadway of blood vessels and special pathways for the fluid that surrounds the brain, plus the magnitude of other structures to help hold everything in place, and you end up with a very, very tightly packed space within your own skull. And yet your brain is 70% water. In some ways, these brain cells are nothing like buildings, for buildings are static, dead structures. But the cells in your brain, they are alive, vivacious, they teem with activity. Every minute of every day, they are dynamic, forever interacting, exchanging messages, creating new ones, checking back, following paths, building up new connections and tearing down old ones. These cells seem to quiver like overstimulated children with too much sugar. We now have the technology to see these cells, to see living cells interacting with each other. We can see the electricity between them. We can see the chemical messages they share. We can stimulate the cells and watch the molecules within the cells moving from one part of the cell to another. We can map out what areas of the brain are connected to specific functions. And yes, we are beginning to understand how memories are created. We are making great strides towards understanding some of the diseases that can affect the brain and are learning to take measures to prevent, or at least minimize, these effects. We have tremendous technical tools to see spectacular specifics of living, functioning brain cells. We have answered so many questions in neuroscience, such as, how does the body direct its movement and functions? And how does the body take in the five senses? But there are still some very fundamental questions about the brain that are yet to be answered. For example, how do feelings influence the brain cells? And how do the brain cells influence the feelings? How or why do we sleep? How do we think? Where is the mind generated? What is it about the brain that allows us to be consciously aware of our consciousness? How do we know that we know what we know? These are questions that have been pondered for centuries. Will you be one of the people to help find the answers? The brain is a complex organ. We have gained so much knowledge about it, and yet there is still so much more to learn. The human brain, a million tiny cities interacting. I touched on the fact that we now are starting to make great strides towards understanding some of the diseases that can affect the brain, and are learning to take measures to prevent or at least minimize these effects. I'd now like to introduce you to a list of some neuropathologies that are involved with the nervous system. These are things that can go wrong with the nervous system. Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia in older adults, with dementia defined as a progressive decline in cognitive function. Cerebral palsy is an umbrella term encompassing a group of non-progressive, non-contagious conditions that cause physical disability in human development. True clinical depression is a mood disorder in which feelings of sadness, loss, anger, or frustration interfere with everyday life for an extended period of time. Current research has found a physical basis for this mood disorder. Epilepsy is a common, chronic neurological disorder that is characterized by recurrent, unprovoked seizures. Multiple sclerosis is an autoimmune condition in which the immune system attacks the central nervous system, leading to demyelination. It may cause numerous physical and mental symptoms and often progresses to physical and cognitive disability. Schizophrenia is a psychiatric diagnosis that describes a mental disorder characterized by abnormalities in the perception or expression of reality. Studies suggest that genetics, early environment, neurobiology, physiological and social processes are important contributing factors. Spinal paralysis is the complete loss of muscle function for one or more muscle groups, loss of feeling or loss of mobility in the affected area, most often caused by damage to the nervous system or brain, especially the spinal cord. Stroke is the rapidly developing loss of brain functions due to a disturbance in the blood vessels supplying blood to the brain. As a result, the affected area of the brain is unable to function, leading to inability to move one or more limbs on one side of the body, inability to understand or formulate speech, or inability to see one side of the visual field, depending on which particular blood vessels are involved. As you can see from this list of neuropathologies, interruption in the proper functioning of the nervous system can lead to dire consequences. Therefore, building an understanding of the nervous system is of crucial importance to learning how to effectively prevent and treat these life-altering pathologies. This is the end of the second topic in the tutorial. As a learning aid, we are providing you with the following stop and think activity. Take a moment to list at least 4 of the neuropathologies outlined in this topic. You are given 9 neuropathologies. When you can easily list at least 4 of these, move to the next slide. In the third topic within tutorial number 1, we will be exploring the history of neuroscience, with the intent of building a strong foundation of understanding regarding when and why basic concepts were discovered in this field of study. This exploration will also help you, the learner, to understand where scientists went wrong in their thinking and what evidence emerged to assist them in correcting their concepts. We will first look at the origins of neuroscience way back in time, and then present key findings in ancient Greece, during the Roman Empire, and during the time of the Renaissance to the 19th century. We will then summarize the 19th century view of neuroscience and explore common concepts held at that time to include key concepts that have lasted the test of time. These concepts include such ideas that nerves act as wires, specific functions are localized within specific regions of the brain, and the nervous system has undergone evolution. Let's begin. In order to aid you in your understanding of the timeline of neuroscience, the following illustration has been developed. If you look at a timeline from way back over 7,000 years BC to the current time, you can see some key discoveries in neuroscience. We'll start with addressing them from way back in 7,000 BC, in which we find evidence of purposeful neurosurgery. We will then look at findings in ancient Egypt before appreciating the long period of time where neuroscience concepts remained unchanged, until new discoveries in ancient Greece. We will then explore key findings during the Roman Empire that again remained virtually unchanged for an extended period of time. The rise of technology helped scientists to establish new mechanistic concepts in the 1500s, in which they purported a man-as-machine view of neuroscience. It wasn't until the 1700s that the advancement of the microscope helped scientists to counter some of the long-held concepts in neuroscience, and they could actually see the structures involved within the system. By the late 1800s, many of the basic concepts we still hold today were established, but it was with the discovery of electricity that the newest concepts were established within the scientific community and filtered down to the general public. Let's look at each of these historical time periods, starting back in ancient times. To look at the origins of neuroscience, we look at archaeological records from over 7,000 years ago, in which we find evidence of trepanation. Trepanation is the act of people boring holes in the skull of another person with the intent of curing them. This is seen by evidence of healing after the operation, indicating this procedure was carried out on living subjects, not merely a ritual conducted after death. It is thought this procedure was probably done to treat headaches or mental illness. Some individuals apparently survived multiple skull surgeries. Over 5,000 years ago in ancient Egypt, writings show that physicians were aware of many symptoms of brain damage. However, they believed that the heart, not the brain, was the center of consciousness and memories. In fact, although the rest of the body was well preserved after death, in ancient Egypt, the brain was simply scooped out through the nostrils and discarded. This ancient view of the seat of consciousness and memories being held in the heart instead of the brain was not challenged until the time of ancient Greece and Hippocrates. During the time of ancient Greece, scientists developed some obvious and some not so obvious conclusions regarding the brain. Anyone would be able to conclude that the brain is the organ of sensation. All you need to do is look closely at the organs of a cadaver to see there are connections from the ears, the eyes, and the mouth to the brain. Indeed, scientists in the time of ancient Greece were quite proficient at conducting autopsies and found long white lines, now referred to as nerves, that traveled from various parts of the body through the spinal cord and up to the brain. If you close your eyes, you can immediately know that the brain, through the connection to the eyes, is involved in perceiving sight. The same can be said for hearing. Thus, it was rather easily determined that the brain is the organ of sensation. Added to this is the easily demonstrated concept that function follows structure. The structure of the feet make them much more conducive to being involved in walking than, say, the structure of the hands, which are much more conducive to functions involving dexterity, such as picking up a pencil or picking up a glass of water. Thus, for basic functions of the human body, the brain became established as the organ of sensation. However, a much more ambiguous conclusion came with Hippocrates' idea that the brain was the seat of the intellect. Since ancient Egyptian times, it had been believed that the heart was the organ of the intellect. Don't we feel a pain in our heart when we're very sad? When was the last time you felt a pain in your brain when you were sad? It isn't surprising that given the scientific tools of the time, Hippocrates' idea of the brain being the seat of the intellect was not widely accepted. The belief in the concept as the heart as the center of the intellect was further endorsed by another Greek, Aristotle. Aristotle believed that the brain was used merely as a radiator for cooling the blood that was overheated by the seething heart. He argued that the rational temperament of humans, compared to other animals, explained the large cooling capacity of our brain. It wasn't until the time of the Roman Empire that further advances were made in neuroscience. During the time of the gladiators, a physician and writer by the name of Galen had the misfortune of seeing the evidence of many spinal cord and brain injuries. Being an early scientist, Galen made careful observations and notes regarding what he saw. He also carried out many animal dissections to understand the connections between areas of the body and the brain. Galen observed two major portions of the brains he dissected, the cerebrum and the cerebellum, and he correctly deduced the function of each. He concluded that the cerebrum was the center for sensations, while the cerebellum was the center for controlling muscles. However, Galen's crude dissections also led him to discover the fluid-filled sections of the brain, and coupled with the prevailing theory of the day that the body functioned according to the balance of four vital fluids, he incorrectly deduced that sensations were registered and movements initiated by the movement of fluids to and from the brain ventricles via the nerves, which he thought of as hollow tubes filled with fluid, much like the blood vessels. This concept was referred to as the fluid mechanical theory of brain function. Remember, microscopes hadn't been invented yet, so Galen was doing the best he could with the tools available to him. These views regarding neuroscience remained in place virtually unchanged for almost 1,500 years until the time of the Renaissance. While more detail was added to the structure of the brain during the Renaissance, the idea of ventricle localization and the fluid mechanical theory of brain function remained essentially unchallenged. The invention of hydraulically controlled mechanical devices during this time added support to the theory. Added to this was the work being done by René Descartes, who convincingly explained animal behavior as a purely mechanistic response and became a strong advocate for the fluid mechanical theory. However, it was also Descartes who gave humans the distinct place in nature as being the only animal to possess both an intellect and a soul. It wasn't until late in the 17th century and early in the 18th century that physicians and scientists were able to observe both gray and white matter in the brain and correctly see and trace the fibers found in the white matter to and from the gray matter. By the end of the 18th century, the nervous system had been completely dissected and its gross anatomy described in detail. It was at this time that scientists realized the nervous system had a central component, the brain and spinal cord, and a peripheral component, a network of nerves throughout the body. Galen's theory was being adamantly questioned. Let's recap the neuroscience concepts held by the end of the 18th century, for these concepts set the stage for an explosion of knowledge to come. By the end of the 18th century, strong evidence suggested that injury to the brain caused disruption in both sensations and movement, and that injury to the spinal cord or brain could even cause death. It was now known that nerves allowed the brain to communicate with the body, and allowed the body to communicate with the brain. Careful observation and study had revealed that the brain consists of distinct parts, which probably carry out different distinct functions. It was also believed that the brain did operate like a machine and followed the laws of nature. But it's during the next 100 years that more would be learned about the functions of the brain than had been learned in all of previously recorded history, and provides a solid foundation on which modern neuroscience rests. A common theme throughout scientific discoveries is that new technologies from many different fields of study helped to provide new tools and new ways of looking at old problems. The same is true for neuroscience. While the stage had been set in the 18th century, it was Benjamin Franklin's discovery of electricity that really helped neuroscientists to provide a new theory of communication conduction within the nervous system. Until then, while it was clear that nerves were not hollow tubes through which fluid flowed, no one had been able to come up with a reasonable theory as to how nerves functioned. In 1751, Benjamin Franklin published his pamphlet, Experiments and Observations on Electricity. This started a flurry of activity in the neuroscientific community. Around the turn of the century, publications started to arrive in which Italian and German scientists had used electricity to stimulate muscles and also found that the brain generated electricity. Finally, a theory emerged in which it was believed that nerves acted as electrical wires to pass signals to and from the brain. Once the electrical theory of nerve conduction was established, further refinements began to emerge. One of the key areas asked the question, do the same wires, meaning nerves, that signal muscle movement also register sensation from the skin? Said another way, scientists wondered if the nerves could conduct bidirectional signals. Experiments in electricity were indicating that wires could only conduct in one direction. So how could the electrical theory of nerve conduction be true? Evidence in agreement with bidirectional conduction included observing that if a nerve were severed, both movement and sensation were lost. However, further careful dissection of nerves found that each nerve contained a number of different fibers. Might it not be possible that some of the fibers carried sensation to the brain, while other fibers found in the same nerve carried signals out to the muscles? This question was answered in 1810, when careful observation of how nerves attached to the spinal cord revealed that just before attaching, the nerve split into two main branches, with one branch attaching towards the back of the spinal cord, the dorsal surface, and the other attaching towards the front of the spinal cord, the ventral surface. Careful experiments revealed that if the dorsal branch were severed, the animal experienced loss of sensation, while if the ventral root were severed, loss of movement ensued. Thus, it was concluded that the fibers entering the dorsal portion of the spinal cord carried signals in one direction toward the brain involving sensation, while the fibers from the same nerve entering the ventral portion of the spinal cord carried signals from the brain to the muscle. Needless to say, this was a huge discovery in the neuroscientific world and established the electrical theory of nerve conduction once and for all. One of the other burning questions early in the 19th century was that of specific localization of function within specific and reproducible locations within the brain. Unfortunately, many people were misled by the work being done by Franz Gall. Gall and his followers carefully measured the skulls of hundreds of people representing the extensive range of personality types, and concluded that bumps on the surface of the skull reflect the bumps on the surface of the brain, and that the propensity of certain personality traits could be related to the dimensions of the head. The science of phrenology captured the popular imagination of the time. However, more serious scientists utilized the experimental ablation methods to localization of function to specific areas of the brain. Using animal models, these scientists would systematically destroy specific parts of the brain and test to see where a deficit in function would become evident. Solid evidence was provided to show that the cerebellum did indeed coordinate movement, and that the cerebrum was involved in sensation and perception. In 1861, after careful examination of a patient with a lesion in his frontal lobe and many other patients, a neurologist by the name of Paul Broca concluded that the region of the lesion of the human cerebrum was specifically responsible for the production of speech. This was an obvious conclusion due to the fact that these patients could understand language, as seen through writing and pointing, but could not speak, even though there were no anatomical abnormalities seen in their vocal cords or facial muscles. Further experiments then negated phrenology and supported localization of function in specific areas of the brain, and these were carried out in the late 1800s by applying electrical currents to specific regions of the brain and eliciting specific reactions that were consistent from animal to animal. In 1859, English biologist Charles Darwin published his landmark work on the Origin of Species. As we all know, he articulated the theory of evolution and outlined the process of natural selection. What is not so well known is that Darwin included behavior among the heritable traits that could evolve. Behaviors such as the flight or fight response show the same physiological reaction in all mammals. The pupils dilate, the heart races, and the hairs stand on end. This indicates that these species evolved from a common ancestor, which possessed the same behavior trait. He could then infer that the brain mechanisms that underlie this fear reaction may be similar, if not identical, across all these species. This rationale is used for relating the results of animal experiments to humans, the use of animal models. However, caution does need to be used when utilizing animal models to ensure that species-specific behaviors are not included. For example, the highly enhanced sense of smell but poor eyesight in rats does not reflect that seen in humans. These specialized behaviors are correlated with a specialized environment for each species. As we complete the third topic in this tutorial, take a moment to complete the following matching question. Match the dates on the left side to the key event on the right side, then check to see if you are correct. The dates are 7000 BC, 4th century BC, 130 to 200 AD, 1859, and lastly, 1870 to 1880. And these are the events that occurred: the fluid mechanical theory, trepanation, where is the seat of the intellect, localization, and Darwin. How would you match these up? 7000 BC. That was where neurosurgery was first discovered, called trepanation. 4th century BC. That's when they first started looking for the seat of the intellect. 130 to 200 AD. That's when they came up with the fluid mechanical theory. 1859, Charles Darwin. And 1870 to 1880, they were looking for localization of function in specific areas of the brain. The final topic of this tutorial will look at the current views in neuroscience. It will cover the cell theory, the concept of neuroscience being an integrative science, present various types of experimental neuroscientists, and outline four key medical specialists involved with the nervous system. The cell theory established the neuron as the basic functional unit of the nervous system. Technological advances in the 1800s helped scientists to delve deeper and deeper into the brain. One great invention that helped was the microscope. Scientists of the day used the microscope to look at smaller and smaller components of tissues. In 1839, Theodor Schwann examined many tissues, including the brain, and concluded that all tissues are composed of microscopic units called cells. This theory was referred to as the cell theory, and it continues to exist today. The specific cells within the brain were referred to as nerve cells, and today they're called neurons. However, there was a great controversy as to whether the individual nerve cells were indeed the basic unit of brain function, or whether it was the multitude of projections that could be seen to extend from the central cell body. Initially, due to the limitations of the current microscopes, scientists could not decide whether the processes from different cells fused together like the blood vessels, or if they left a space between them and had to send some kind of a signal across to the next cell. It wasn't until the early 1900s that microscopes had been improved enough to prove that neurons were not fused together, and thus the neuron was the basic unit of the nervous system. History clearly indicates that understanding how the brain works is a huge challenge. To reduce the complexity of the problem, neuroscientists break it into smaller pieces for systematic experimental analysis, the reductionist approach. In this fast-paced, exciting field of study, the greatest advances in neuroscience are achieved when scientists realize the best hope for understanding the workings of the brain come from an interdisciplinary approach. Neuroscience research can be divided into two types: experimental or foundational research carried out by PhDs, and clinical or medical research carried out by medical doctors. We will look at each of these in turn. There are various types of experimental neuroscientists. A molecular neurobiologist uses genetic material of neurons to understand function and structure of brain molecules. A developmental neurobiologist analyzes the development and maturation of the brain. A neuroanatomist studies the structure of the nervous system, whereas neurochemists studies the chemistry of the nervous system. Neuroetiologists look at the neural basis of species-specific behavior. Neuropharmacologists look at the effects of drugs on the nervous system. Neurophysiologists measure electrical activity of the nervous system. Psychobiologist studies the biological basis of behavior. And psychophysicists quantitatively measure perceptual abilities. There are four main types of medical specialists that are associated with the nervous system. They are as follows. A neurologist is a medical doctor trained to diagnose and treat diseases of the nervous system. A psychiatrist is a medical doctor trained to diagnose and treat disorders of mood and personality. A neurosurgeon is a medical doctor trained to perform surgery on the brain and spinal cord. And a neuropathologist is a medical doctor or PhD trained to recognize changes in neural tissue resulting from disease. As we complete the final topic of this tutorial, use this multiple choice question to test your understanding of the various types of neuroscientists. The question is, this type of neuroscientist uses genetic material of neurons to understand function and structure of the brain molecules. Is it a neurophysiologist, a developmental neurobiologist, a neuroanatomist, a psychophysicist, or a molecular neurobiologist? If you chose a molecular neurobiologist, you are correct. If you did not get the correct answer, go back over this section of the tutorial until you have a clear understanding of the different types of neuroscientists. As a summary of Tutorial 1, it is good to remember the purpose of this tutorial, which was to introduce you to the field of neuroscience. In doing so, we covered four main topics. We first explored the meaning of neuroscience and discovered that neuroscience is the study of the brain and the nervous system. We then discovered that understanding neuroscience will assist us in understanding behavior and neuropathologies. We then traveled through a brief history of neuroscience from ancient times to the 19th century to uncover the journey of scientific thinking throughout the ages. We concluded this tutorial by outlining the current thinking regarding neuroscience to include the cell theory, the brain as an electric organ, and explored various interdisciplinary fields of study for experimental and medical specialists. Studying neuroscience involves a great deal of information from a variety of sources. It can become overwhelming, but studying hard is not necessary if you study smart. Smart studying involves a number of key techniques. The first technique involves understanding the concepts instead of just memorizing the details. How many times have you sat in an examination and knew that you had studied the material, but for some reason the answers just weren't coming to you? If you understand the concepts first, then you can anchor the details into the concept so that when you need to remember the detail, you can first think of the concept and you'll have a much better chance of recalling the details. For example, understand the misguided concept of the fluid mechanical model of nerve conduction. Then you can recall the time in history when it was first developed and understand how and why this became an established model. You can then recall key times in history when it was supported and also recall who, when, and how it was proven to be incorrect. Second technique, connect the concepts together in a mind map so you can see the flow of one concept to another and then fill in the details around each concept. For example, connect the fluid mechanical model of nerve conduction to the electrical model of nerve conduction. This allows you to recall one when you recall the other, and visually see how they connect. Third technique, take your time to go back over each topic in a tutorial. Ensure you understand each topic before proceeding, since many of the topics build on previous ones. Also take the time to review the tutorial before continuing to the next one. The cheat sheet provided for you is ideal for this purpose. Next technique, use the stop and think questions provided at the end of each topic to test yourself on your understanding of each topic. If you did not get the correct answer, or were not clear about what the question was asking, go back through the topic and learn before proceeding to the next topic. Another technique, use the problem set at the end of each tutorial to quiz yourself. It is a valuable tool to assist you in seeing what you have learned and what you need to review again before continuing on to the next tutorial. This is especially important in neuroscience, as each tutorial tends to build on knowledge gained in previous ones. Another technique, talk out loud to yourself during the tutorials. Yes, this is acceptable behavior for neuroscientists. Repeat the information given to you. Studies have shown that when a person hears the information at the same time as seeing it, they will retain more information. That is why you were provided with audio as well as visual information in this program. However, it is also important to hear yourself say the words. So repeat the sentences after they are presented to you, or say them in your own words. If you can say them, you can learn them. Last technique, remember to take breaks often. This doesn't mean to study for 10 minutes and take 90-minute breaks. It means to study until you find your attention drifting away, and then get up and take a short break. Do something entirely different, such as physical exercise. Go for a walk, clean your room, get a drink of water. If you are studying this course on a computer, don't just change over to looking at email or playing a video game. Get away from the computer for the break. But then come back after a few minutes, no longer than 10 minutes. These tutorials are constructed to allow you to go through the material in 30 minutes for a reason. Use these tips to study. They will help. Finally, congratulations. You have now completed the first tutorial within the neuroscience course. By completing this tutorial, you have gained a basic understanding of how this dynamic science has evolved over time and learned to appreciate the incredible opportunities for discovery and advancement within neuroscience. You have also set a solid groundwork for further explorations in neuroscience. Well done! For more audio and visual tutorials in chemistry, biology, physics, and math, go to www.rapidlearningcenter.com. Thank you.